Welcome. Today is Monday, July 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the country grieves a series of painful shootings.
We need to come together, all of us, black, white, pink, yellow, whoever you are, to make a difference and make change that needs to happen now, that needs to happen yesterday.
The violence and ongoing protests prompt the president to cut short a visit to Spain. Violence in South Sudan creates chaos and uncertainty. Renewed efforts for peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. This could be a big week for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Also ahead, the results from Wimbledon, all on today's International Edition. Glad you could be here. Well, it's been a painfully difficult week here in the United States. First, with two fatal police shootings of African-American men, and an ambush that killed five law enforcement officers in Dallas, Texas. President Barack Obama is cutting a visit to Spain short so he can come home to respond to the tragedies. A day after attending the NATO summit in Warsaw, Poland, the president devoted much of his news conference to events back home.
We've had a difficult week back in the United States, so my trip is a little abbreviated, but I thought it was very important for me to come here, given the extraordinary friendship and alliance that exists between Spain and the United States.
Well, the president is calling on Americans to mutually respect fellow citizens.
Now, this week, people felt hurt and angry, and so some of this is just venting. But I think that the overwhelming majority of people who are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, what they really want to see is a better relationship between the police and the community so that they can feel that it's serving them.
Well, scores of demonstrators have protested police brutality against black men around the United States, even as the nation reels from all that has happened in the past week. In the northern city of St. Paul, Minnesota, hundreds of protesters hurled firecrackers, rocks, and bottles at police, while heavily armed officers used smoke grenades and pepper spray to break up demonstrations late Saturday. More than 60 people were arrested, but demonstrators say they are there to speak out for injustice.
We're not out here to have no drama with the police or try to make it like it's we trying to hurt something or do something. We just out here for justice for the man that got killed.
International Edition's Jim Stevenson talked about what's been happening with VOA correspondent Jim Malone.
We've been looking for years at an issue when it comes to minority communities in this country, their relationship with the local law enforcement, when that breaks down, how people are treated. And there have been a number of, let's say, shootings, questionable deaths of minority individuals in our country over the years. The most recent incidents were in Minnesota and in Louisiana, two separate shootings, but happening one right after the other. And there was a great deal of anger about that. And there were vigils and protests held in many parts of the country. One of them was in Dallas, Texas, and there was a sizable police presence there, not to break it up because this was a peaceful protest, but you had people exercising their right to free speech, to free association, to demonstrate peacefully. And there was a sizable police presence there to protect them and to assure that everything was maintained in an orderly fashion, and shots rang out. This is sort of a new wrinkle in what is a truly depressing facet of modern American life.
The one in Minnesota, particularly a poignant incident because it was captured not only on a cell phone but streamed live as it happened on Facebook. And the entire country within a short period of time became a witness to this incident. The actual shooting was not captured, but the immediate aftermath was.
What this would seem to bring to light is the fact that what has been publicized to great effect in recent years is probably something that has been going on for a very long time, but now technology is such that the world can be made aware of it instantly. And there have indeed been instances of questionable police shootings being captured by someone's phone. We are in an era where technology has made this sort of thing possible. And you see police forces responding by putting cameras on the vests or on the lapels of all their officers. Dashboard cameras are now standard. They have been for quite some time. But clearly, there is a difference between what we used to hear, what we used to see years ago, which was we would read about it in the local newspaper, and there was a sense of separation from the event. But when you have things captured by people's cell phones and other devices and posted immediately, and you sense that immediacy, I think that the potential for frayed nerves to go awry and for people to run amok is definitely heightened.
President Obama, of course, in Europe for the NATO summit in Warsaw, Poland, on to Spain, and he is coming back to the United States and on his way to Dallas in the coming days.
Yes, he will be going there. And I mean, I think we sometimes forget that this is our nation's first African-American president. And I think that there was some hope, some expectation that merely the fact of elevating our first African-American person to the highest office in the land, that would provide some sort of magical healing potion across the country, that maybe things would improve, that race relations would get better. Clearly, that has not happened. And I suspect that as the president looks to his legacy and what he's leaving behind after 8 years in office, I suspect that one of his regrets will be that more progress was not made.
That was International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaking with VOA correspondent Jim Malone. President Obama, by the way, will travel to Dallas on Tuesday to speak at a memorial for the slain law enforcement officers. Turning now to social media with VOA's G. Abby Lee. Obviously, we have been hearing social media has played a big part in exposing these types of situations that have been happening. What's trending, G?
Hi, Lori. All over America, the aftermath of the two police shootings in Louisiana, Minnesota are still being felt. And of course, what happened in Dallas is also very worrisome. Hashtag Black Lives Matter is still trending, and hundreds of protesters have been arrested in several states. Where we're located, Washington, D.C., is not an exception. And in Minnesota, where Philando Castile's death was streamed live, at least 21 officers were reportedly hurt by protesters.
What is the trending story about the arrests? I know that a prominent Black Lives Matter activist has been arrested and now since then been released.
You're absolutely right. His name is DeRay McKesson, and he was arrested in Louisiana. I also want to note that he wore a T-shirt that had hashtag Stay Woke written on it. And that means, I don't know if you know that meaning.
Mm-mm.
Do you?
No.
Well, hashtag Stay Woke means you stay enlightened and stay interested in what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's such millennial jargon, by the way.
Interesting.
The Wall Street Journal posted a report on the developing story on Facebook, and it seems like many of its readers are not supporting the movement. One of the most liked comments asks, if Black Lives Matter so much to this group, why are they not in Detroit helping those that need them? Black people are murdering other Black people every day, which is a really big assumption, by the way, and there is no protest there. Now, responding to that comment, many people pointed out that just because these crimes exist, that doesn't mean there is no problem with the interaction between the police force and the African-American community.
Very interesting.
Right.
Let's dig a bit deeper into the social media element of all of this, particularly the Minnesota incident, mm-hmm. which was a police shooting that was streamed live just after it happened. What was the reaction like from Facebook execs?
Well, as you can imagine, Facebook executives share their sentiments and even personal developments like, you know, weddings and partners passing away on Facebook. And this week, both its founder, Mark Zuckerberg, and COO, Sheryl Sandberg, posted about the death of Philando Castile in Minnesota. Zuckerberg, in particular, wrote about Castile, and here's a snippet. While I hope we never have to see another video like Diamonds, who is the fiancé of the deceased Castile, it reminds us why coming together to build a more open and connected world is so important and how far we still have to go. That's all for me today. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. And you can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Islamic State continues to lose territory in Iraq and Syria. Presidential candidates vow to rebuild in the wake of U.S. shootings. Family of a slain U.S. reporter sues Syria. 10 more U.S. states sue over transgender bathroom guidelines. And 3 of the 5 Spice Girls hint of a reunion. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com or download our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in this heated and deeply divisive campaign year, America's presidential candidates responded Friday with striking reflection and restraint to the week's killings of 5 police officers and 2 Black men. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump quickly scrapped most political events. Now, going into a new week here, we are hearing that Bernie Sanders is getting closer to offering his public endorsement of Hillary Clinton, possibly at a campaign event in New Hampshire on Tuesday. Joining me now to talk about it and all things politics, chief political reporter for Politico, Glenn Thrush. Thanks so much for being here, Glenn. So if this does happen, what did it take for Sanders to finally be willing to endorse Clinton?
Well, I think the issue with Bernie Sanders was less about policy, and there's been kind of a debate down in Orlando with the Democratic Policy Platform Committee, and there's been some wrangling over international trade and issues like Wall Street reform and campaign finance reform. But the truth of the matter is this really had a lot more to do with Sanders coming to the recognition that he wasn't going to actually be able to prevail. I think it took him a lot longer than a lot of folks on the Clinton side certainly wanted, a lot longer than other people appreciated. This is a guy who was speaking before crowds of 18,000 a couple of weeks ago. And now he's got to go back and kind of be a backbencher senator, albeit one with more authority.
But Hillary Clinton won fair and square, right? She got more votes.
She got 3 million more votes. She won in most of the biggest states, with the one exception being Michigan. She overwhelmingly won with the party's base of African-Americans, Latinos, and educated adults. Sanders put up a heck of a fight and clearly ought to have a seat at the table. But the bell that ended this contest officially was a couple of weeks ago when Elizabeth Warren, who really is the head of the movement that Sanders currently, when Elizabeth Warren endorsed Hillary, I think that really did it.
So is it all business, or will he actually mean it when he gets out there on the campaign trail with her?
I've covered politics long enough to know that meaning it doesn't really matter that much.
And by the way,
the process itself creates an authenticity. You know, I was there in 2008 when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama packed the combined press corps of the who'd been covering the two campaigns onto a plane, shipped us up to Unity, New Hampshire. Didn't look like those guys were going to come together, and within a few weeks they did.
What kind of weight do you think it will have? Do you think it would have carried more weight if it had come earlier, and will it sway his diehard reporters?
The interesting thing that has occurred statistically is around this time in the 2008 race, only about 69% to 75% of Hillary Clinton supporters had jumped onto the Obama bandwagon. That number is now closer to 81% to 90%, according to some polls that I've seen recently. So that transition has already happened. To a certain extent, Sanders, in this protracted negotiation with the Clinton folks, has squandered away potential leverage. I don't know what he could have gotten, but I think a big problem for Sanders was the fact that he really didn't know what to get out of this process.
Interesting. Okay, well, so let's turn to Donald Trump. Any new insights about a vice presidential pick? We're hearing that he will be making that announcement sometime this week.
Well, he has to. I mean, the convention starts a week from Monday.
Could he just spring it on everybody at the convention, or is it in his best interest to roll this person out ahead of time?
Well, Trump has never done anything conventional during this entire campaign.
Very true.
And he's got a big problem here. A lot of the top-tier candidates, don't kid yourself, the people that are currently being cycled around are either second-tier candidates or people who are outside the box. The real frontier candidates don't want anything to do with them. So that's a big problem, and that could push him back to the convention. People saying no. At the moment, the hot rumor is Indiana Governor Mike Pence, a very conservative guy, a guy who clearly wants to be at the center of things. There's been some talk about a retired general who's been a registered Democrat. That's been tamped down a little bit, though that could pop up again. And you basically have this prospect of Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, auditioning in public time and time again for Trump. Gingrich, I think, is positioning himself as the parachute. If everything else fails, you know, pull the ripcord and Newt will pop out.
What about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie?
That seems to be a lot less likely. You know, and that's a bit of a puzzle. Chris Christie is a former prosecutor. He's a guy who has had real executive experience. But the real reason, I think, from people I've spoken to, is that Trump simply doesn't want someone with that strong a personality down ballot. I mean, Trump is a guy who acts as his own press secretary and campaign manager. And to a certain extent, I would anticipate that he wants to be his own running mate.
So does it matter more in this volatile election cycle than it may in some other year as far as who Donald Trump picks for a running mate?
I'll give you two answers. The first answer is who knows, because everything is so unpredictable with Trump. And the second answer is it is huge. And it's huge because Trump is such a weak candidate. We haven't seen a major presidential candidate really going back, I would say, to Goldwater. And even then, that's a hard comparison to make, who is entering the general election as weak as Trump is. You know, there's a Pew poll that came out having him down 9 nationally. But the real problem he has is all these subgroups. Pretty much everyone under the age of 65, every group is overwhelmingly going for Hillary Clinton. So it's hard to say what will and won't help him.
Could it turn enough people around, though, if he picks someone that Republicans like?
Has never happened in history before and will never happen this year. A choice of a running mate is an important choice. You know, Barack Obama surprised a lot of people by picking Joe Biden. John McCain surprised a lot more people by picking Sarah Palin. You can argue that the Sarah Palin pick was the most consequential vice presidential pick in recent history, because people who were inclined not to vote for John McCain saw Palin and decided to abandon him entirely. So to a certain extent, a vice presidential pick almost works more powerfully in the negative. So if Trump picks somebody who is categorically unacceptable, prone to gaffes, alienates even more people, it could be worse. I think at the best he can hope for is a little bit of a bump and a neutral.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Thanks so much, Glenn Thrush. We'll wait and see. Chief political correspondent for Politico. Well, on the 5th anniversary of its independence Saturday, South Sudan's capital has been rocked all weekend by violence between forces loyal to the president and those loyal to the vice president. There are reports of widespread casualties and fears the country is returning to civil war. A UN mission spokeswoman is confirming that a UN armored personnel carrier was hit by a shell at a camp to protect civilians. UN peacekeepers in the vehicle were wounded, according to witnesses. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us now with the latest. Margaret?
Well, since about Thursday, there's been a lot of fighting in Juba town in the capital, and it's the army, which belongs to President Salva Kiir, and the opposition forces, which belong to Riek Machar. And, you know, these two had supposedly reconciled, but on Thursday there was an incident at a checkpoint, I believe, and several soldiers were killed, and it was the two sides again fighting. And it seems to have triggered a very dangerous, you know, confrontation between the two, and thousands of people have been displaced and civilians are threatened. Aid workers can't reach them. So it's really compounded what has already been a very difficult humanitarian situation in South Sudan.
And the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting. You have been tracking that. What are they saying and what are they thinking of doing?
Right. So the council had a rare Sunday late afternoon meeting for several hours behind closed doors. And what they said when they came out is that they're considering raising the troop level to the UN force there. So basically, the Security Council is the MIS, the UN mission in South Sudan. And several years ago, they authorized it. And so they are the ones who are responsible for it. And there are about 12,000 soldiers and 1,200 police under the UN flag there, and they're struggling to protect all these civilians. Many of them have sought shelter at the UN bases, which are not intended to be any sort of a camp for displaced people. But the situation has been so grave since December 2013 that this is what has happened. So the council said they're considering raising the levels of troops there to assist the civilians. They're worried the fighting could spread. You know, it's not just in Juba. There's been heavy fighting and violence in Wau, in Bentiu, So, you know, if there's a general deterioration across the country, this is also extremely worrying that it's escalating.
Is there anything at this point they can do to quell this?
Aside from sending more troops and sending them quickly, maybe bring them from Congo or someplace nearby, because that's the other problem at the UN. Oftentimes they will deploy peacekeepers, but it can take 3 months to deploy them. And if the violence is today, 3 months isn't going to really help. So they have to be able to react quickly in a way that will actually make a meaningful difference on the ground. The other thing the council is doing is calling on Riek Machar and Salva Kiir to get their men under control. I mean, this sort of shows that they can't even control their own soldiers. So it's a very worrying sign in that sense, too. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power spoke to reporters before she went into the council this afternoon, and she said that this issue, this lack of command and control over their soldiers, is very concerning. And she said that the attacks are deplorable and that there needs to be accountability. And I think that's another big issue in South Sudan. Will there be hybrid courts for justice? What will happen? Will the International Criminal Court have to get involved? What will happen? So I think the council is looking at options. There has been talk for a long time about an arms embargo. Several council members have not been keen on it, but perhaps now this may change their minds. I don't know, but I'm sure those who want it will certainly try and use this to persuade them to accept it.
Is there any concern about the safety of foreigners or Americans or U.S. embassy or any of the embassies?
There was fighting this week actually near the European Union compound, around the presidential palace, near the U.N. development program, UNDP's compound, not just near the peacekeeping base. Everybody is concerned for everybody's safety. Civilians are trying to hide in their homes, and there have been reports that soldiers have been coming to their homes and checking IDs. And so there's concern for people in the street and in their homes. I mean, the situation is very chaotic, very confusing.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, thanks so much. Well, Egypt's foreign minister paid a rare visit to Israel on Sunday in hopes of reviving the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Sameh Shoukry saying that his country remains a steadfast and unwavering supporter of an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, but warns that conditions for achieving that are deteriorating.
It is no longer acceptable to claim that the status quo is the most that we can achieve of the hopes and aspirations of the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. The current state of affairs, unfortunately, is neither stable nor sustainable and does not conform with the hopes and aspirations of both peoples nor with those of the peoples of the region and the world.
Speaking at a news conference alongside Palestinian President Benjamin Netanyahu, who has so far made no headway since taking office back in 2009.
Today I call again on the Palestinians to follow the courageous examples of Egypt and Jordan and join us for direct negotiations. This is the only way we can address all the outstanding problems between us and turn the vision of peace based on two states for two peoples into a reality.
The Palestinians seek the establishment of an independent state in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, lands captured by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War. Netanyahu has endorsed the idea of an independent Palestinian state, but he opposes a return to Israel's pre-1967 borders and has continued to build Jewish settlements on occupied lands. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Political conventions are a critical part of the American electoral process. Our job is to put the conventions, the candidates, and the issues into context for our listeners. Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic Party's conventions starting July 18th on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. British tennis star Andy Murray has won his second Wimbledon tennis title, defeating Canada's Milos Raonic in straight sets on Sunday. The second-seeded Murray cruised to victory on the grass at Centre Court just outside London to clinch his third career Grand Slam title.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I went 12-0 this season on grass, so yeah, it's unbelievable. I think my game very suits it a lot, and I knew going into grass court, that was very exciting. It. I knew from last year, you know, I beat world number five, first round of Wimbledon last year. So yeah, of course, I love playing on grass.
Raonic was seeking to become the first Canadian player to win a major tennis championship. In Saturday's women's final, American Serena Williams won Wimbledon for the seventh time, finally tying German Steffi Graf for the most titles in major events during the Open era. Williams downed German Angelique Kerber for her 22nd Grand Slam singles crown.
For me, it's unbelievable. It's a feat I couldn't have thought would have happened. So it's amazing.
Williams still needs two more major titles to match Australian Margaret Court's all-time record of 24 Grand Slam crowns. You've been listening to International Edition. We are glad you could join us. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly supports entrepreneurship at home and abroad as a means to create not only prosperity, but peace and stability. Speaking at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "Economic policy is foreign policy, and foreign policy is economic policy, particularly in the globalized world we're living in today." Secretary Kerry encouraged young people in particular to create new businesses, even if they started small. He urged young business owners to not only create new products and turn a profit, but as innovators and entrepreneurs with a stake in society, to also take on some of the societal challenges facing many countries. One of those challenges is violent extremism and the emergence of radical non-state actors who are out to exploit frustrations faced by many young people around the world. Indeed, in the Middle East, Africa, South Central, and East Asia, 60 to 65% of the populations are under the age of 30. These young people, said Secretary Kerry, need education and opportunity as soon as possible to keep them from being lured away by extremist ideologies. Successful new businesses provide inspiration to those who see no potential for improving their own circumstances. Speaking to young entrepreneurs, Secretary Kerry said, "You also provide a highly visible and very effective rebuttal to the propaganda of violent extremist groups, because your optimism provides an alternative to their nihilism, because you're trying to build the brighter future that, in fact, these folks are determined to prevent, because you are living a narrative of modern civilization and progress that is diametrically opposed to the dark worldview of Daesh." Another challenge for young entrepreneurs to take on is corruption. Anyone in local or international business confronts this issue every day in a variety of ways. For entrepreneurs, poor governance can mean the difference between being able to start up or survive or never getting started at all. And there are countless ways that new entrepreneurs can help hold governments accountable. As Secretary Kerry emphasized, you want to be able to open your enterprises without having to pay a bribe or be dependent on making friends in high places. Being a global entrepreneur is about understanding and then using one's power to change the world. It's about leading the world toward a future of prosperity, peace, and progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.